It's time for the Financial Cafe, airing every Saturday morning at 9 a.m. on 88.7 WSIE The Sound. Today's show is underwritten by The Chef Shop, your hometown kitchen accessory store, where a good cup of coffee starts every day right. The views expressed at the Financial Cafe are those of the hosts and do not represent the views of Southern Illinois University Edwardsville, the SIU Board of Trustees, or WSIE Radio. Securities offered through Nickel Investors Corporation at No. 1 Executive Park, Granite City, Illinois, member FINRA and SIPC.
If I had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
I'd be rich.
And now, welcome to the Financial Cafe and our hosts, Larry Lexo and John Graney.
Well, good morning, Terry Lammers.
Good morning.
Glad to have you visit with us this morning. Of course, for those of you who listen to the show, you know, John Graney's usually sitting in that seat over there. So I got a better view today than, you know, when John's here. Sorry, John. And if he's following his pattern, he's about halfway to Wisconsin. So hope you have a good time on vacation, do a little fishing, you know, a little relaxing, and come back fresh, ready for the next show. So we're going to have an interesting discussion this morning, got some key points to kind of cover, and then we're going to go into business valuations. For any of you who own a business, you're probably wondering, or have wondered at some point in time, what the heck is my business worth? If I wanted to sell it, what would it be worth? How would I go about it? What all is involved in that process? And, you know, that's a great question. And Terry is an expert in that area. We're going to be talking in great detail about not only selling a business, but he also deals in buying businesses. So if any of you are interested in either buying or selling, this would be a good opportunity to gather some information, and we'll direct you to his book, which is going to be coming out with some additional information, as well as his website. So I guess we'll get things kicked off. Of course, this is The Financial Cafe. You can reach our website at www.thefinancialcafe.us. And all of our shows do appear out there within a week or two of them airing. So any show that you were not able to listen to, or if you hear this one and want to refer it to someone, particularly for the business valuation information, tell them to go out to our blog, again, www.thefinancialcafe.us, and it will be out there in about 10 days or so. So you can download it, you can listen to it as many times as you want, and get all the information relating to a very important topic. And that, of course, applies to all of our topics we've talked about in the last, I can't believe it's been almost a year that we started the show. It was last July. It was a week after, Saturday after July 4th last year. We began the Financial Cafe. We have since expanded from 30 minutes to 60 minutes, and now we just keep on going. So having more interviews, which is a lot of fun. We want to thank, of course, the Chef Shop, Nancy and Scott Snyder. Saw them on Sunday, Father's Day. Went out to a local restaurant, 1818 Chop House. If you haven't been there, this is not an ad, just a personal opinion. It's great. Saw the folks over there, and Nancy and Scott were both there. They came by, said hi. So holler out hi back to them. And for underwriting the show. Chef Shop's been our sponsor since the beginning. And for those of you who don't know about it or haven't heard, well, you're going to find out, because Chef Shop's located at 2320 Troy Road here in Edwardsville. They're in the Schnucks Plaza right next to Target, and their phone number is 618-659-9840. Although Mother's Day and Father's Day have come and gone, and hopefully you stopped by and got some fun stuff, you know, they have lots of, well, over 70 flavors of popcorn. They have the fudge, and they have coffee. Of course, we've reviewed all 20 or so of their different types of coffees, and they're pretty well-received. My favorite is just about all of them, and John's, of course, we know is the Highland Grog, because it keeps him awake. Terry smiling, he knows how that works, right? So what's going on in the news? Well, the market is continuing up. The Senate GOP is looking at a deadline for coming up with a health care vote. That's certainly a discussion right now. iPhone, is amongst one of the biggest transformations that we've had since iPhone launched in June of 2007. Doesn't hardly seem it's been 10 years ago. It has pretty much surpassed most of the other introductions that happened out there. Gosh, that includes Toyota Corolla was introduced way back when. In 2007, you had the Zippo lighter, the Rubik's Cube, Nintendo, Sony PlayStation, a lot of these before that time, but none of them have reached as many people. The Apple iPhone has reached 1.2 billion people worldwide. So although Steve Jobs isn't around anymore, Tim Cook has taken the helm and I think has done a pretty good job on continuing to transform the company and to develop new things. And of course, now they're talking about a self-driving car. I don't know, Terry, would you buy a self-driving car from Apple?
That sounds kind of scary to me.
Well, you know, for those who can't drive, it's you know, it means a lot to them anyway to have an ability to get around. We've got Uber. You've got a lot of different opportunities to have somebody else drive. But if I could get in the car and just tell it where I want to go, I don't know. I could maybe be convinced. Another big announcement recently, Amazon has put forth, what was it? $3 billion, I think, dollars or so to buy Whole Foods. You know, that one baffles me a little bit because Amazon, of course, is the world's, I believe, largest company at this point in time. But going into the food market, and it's defined that they want to know more about their customers. So they're looking at analyzing the data provided by who's buying what's trending at that particular point in time. And who knows, maybe it won't be long. You'll be going on Amazon and ordering your groceries and have them delivered, and maybe they'll be delivered by drone. I mean, you know, who knows what's coming up down the road. So tax overhaul. Of course, the Speaker Paul Ryan is talking about tax overhaul and hopefully to get something in place maybe this year yet. That would be awesome as the market continues. There's lots of other things going on. Terry, what do you think? They're now the 3D printers have become a big thing out there. They are 3D printing airliner parts.
It's amazing what it's just amazing how technology keeps advancing and advancing. You know, they're making joints and just phenomenal.
Well, the FAA thinks it's a good idea because it's a way of turning out large quantities of high-volume structural parts for jetliners. But they, U.S. safety regulators, are a little bit concerned about having a 3D printer turn out parts for jets. So I guess more on that. We'll kind of see where it ends up going down the road. Let's see, European stocks, U.S. futures wipe out all the gains because oil is dropping again. Terry knows a lot about oil.
You know, it amazes me. It seems like oil being lower is a good thing because it lowers the cost of everything. So it baffled me this whole time that the more oil goes down, the market views that as bad.
It baffles me too, Terry, because to me, if oil goes down, and you understand far more than I, having been in the business relationship, but it seems to me if a barrel of oil costs less, then gasoline should cost less at the pump. UPS, FedEx, whoever, you know, their gas surcharges should go down. I'm not sure they ever do once they go up, but nevertheless, they should go down. Delivery, you know, as I mentioned on the way to the studio, we're waiting on delivery by truck of some materials for a renovation project at my daughter's new insurance office here in Granite, Maryland Moats Lexo Insurance, and we're waiting on for a delivery of some flooring. And you know, it's expensive to ship stuff. You know,
it's the hidden tax. You know, something $4 a gallon versus $2 a gallon is it's a big deal.
Well, it's a big deal, and it is huge because you know they go by weight, of course, and shipping flooring. I guess this shipment, I think this one's maybe 15 or so cartons, and each carton I bet goes 40 pounds, so you know you're talking 500-600 pounds of weight, and it's not cheap to bring that stuff in and deliver it.
No, it's not.
And then on top of that, you know, it's curbside, so they say here it is, drop the pallet, and you know, you get to haul it in. So oh well, enough about that. Let's see what else is going on. I thought this was interesting. It's a Wall Street Journal podcast series, The Future of Everything. Can food waste save the world? I read that and went, what? Celebrity chefs, believe it or not, are now cooking with scraps to feed the homeless. And I don't think off of plates, but you know, when they prep food, they have a lot of leftovers. So it's a comprehensive look at how the food we throw out daily is changing the world for the better. So Anthony Bourdain, who is a chef and singer Ed Sheeran, are evidently involved in a process of taking all the scraps that are left over in the preparation of food at various restaurants and having the chefs turn it into food that can then be packaged and shipped to parts of the world that does not have sufficient food. And we know there are a lot of those out there. So anything to help out would be a big plus. Let's see, what else is going on? Well, let's get into HSAs. We had a discussion a week or so ago, but this is from Investment News and Benefits Advisor. HSAs and 401ks are becoming much more closely linked. I've always said that, but it's back out in the news again, indicating that health savings accounts, for those of you who are not aware, a health savings account is an account in which you can put in tax deductible contributions based on your age and let it accumulate tax-free. So it's considered a triple tax-free type of accumulation. You get a deduction for putting it in. You don't pay any tax on what on the growth, and you don't pay any tax if it is indeed used for medical expenses. So one of the big things that is being recommended by the American Retirement Association, Brian Graff is the CEO over there, is that HSAs are becoming almost mandatory in funding retirement because the cost of health care, we've talked about it on prior shows, for an average 65-year-old today, they're going to spend over $250,000 in health care during their retirement. You know, 30 years, that's a lot of money.
It's scary, isn't it?
Well, and most people don't think about that. They're just happy, if they're so fortunate, they're just happy to have put enough money away for retirement to be able to believe that they're not going to run out. And when you throw in another, you know, $250,000 that is going to have to be spent because that's the deductibles, that's the copays, that's for the drugs, procedures, whatever it happens to be, that are not covered by medical insurance or Medicare or even some of the supplements, because you know, can get a Medicare supplement. Get on the different programs to help cover prescriptions. But there are still costs that are not included in that. It says 80% of Americans really have a high concern about healthcare costs in retirement. That was a survey done by Merrill Lynch, and that healthcare is the largest threat to retirement savings and the most important part of a retirement income plan, and that was according to Fidelity. So HSAs, in addition, I always talk to my young investors at the qualified plans, 401ks we work with. You know, if you're in your 20s or 30s, don't miss out on the compounding of money. You know, over time, get started, you know, as much as you can early. If you can, get up to 12 to 15% a year put into retirement and allowing it to grow. Well, another aspect is don't overlook the HSA account. If you have an HSA-compatible health plan, put that money away for retirement. So when you do retire, you know, you'll have that $250,000 or $200,000, $300,000 sitting there in an HSA account that you can use for paying for your health care, because that's going to be huge as we go forward. And many of our clients, as you know, I'm a big proponent on planning. And a plan consists of, you know, five basic steps. You have to have a written plan, has to have specific time frames, specific objectives. You do have to implement the plan, which is where some people fall down, and then you have to monitor it. So if you do those five things, the studies have shown, this goes back to the 1950s, Harvard did the study that if you do that, it's in writing with specific time frames, specific objectives, you implement and you monitor, you have over a 90% chance of being successful in reaching your goal, whatever it happens to be. And long-term care comes into play because not only that is a component of health care, that's part of that $250,000 cost, and a lot of the long-term care insurers are saying right now the number of insured lives under long-term care plans has finally leveled out. It had been going up over the years from 2002 and now through, looks like the latest data I've got is 2014. So it's a matter of finding a company that is still in the business, because all but about three or four have gotten out of the long-term care business, and then evaluating how that fits into your qualified plan, working with somebody who can play the what-if scenarios to see what would happen if at age 75, 80, whatever it happens to be, one or either, and there's a 25% chance that one or either of the couple at age 65 will end up in long-term care for some period of time during retirement, that they're going to have the ability to fund that. Another thing I thought was kind of interesting, when you hear the word old, Terry, what does that mean to you?
55?
55 is old. Man, I'm in trouble.
Well, I don't know. Every year, older seems to be getting further out.
there is no doubt about that. Absolutely. And the study that was done, it was done by U.S. Trust, it just depends on your perspective. They found that millennials, you know, that group that is the youngest of most of our workers today, the millennials consider people old when they reach the age of 59.
That was close.
Yeah, but you're not a millennial. I know better. You know, while old age really begins, normal retirement age, as it's defined by Social Security, NRA, generally starts at age 65. And Gen Xers, according to the article, thought that 65 was a good age. For baby boomers and the silent generation, old age starts at 73. I like that a lot better. Millennials think that youth ends at age 40. While Gen Xers and baby boomers respondents say that youth stops at age 31. That's just not good. It's not fair. And the silent generation puts the end of youth at about 35. So I can't agree with any of them, actually, because, as you said, the older you get, the older old becomes. I think that's the way it works. When you are planning for retirement, and we'll talk about this and one other thing, we'll get into the meat of today's conversation. When you're planning retirement, make sure that you have a solid plan. Not only do you have a solid financial plan, but also that you have the facts. Because talking to someone very recent, a good friend of mine, who is planning on retiring next June, and they talked to the Social Security office, and Social Security indicated that, you know, they've got their 40 quarters in. Very important that you know that you have your 40 quarters in for Social Security, both for the primary wage earner as well as the spouse to be able to collect benefits. But he also is fortunate enough, I'm not, but many people are, of getting a pension. And his pension will be coming from the SURS system, as long as it exists anyway. That's the State University Retirement System. And he was told by Social Security that it would not have an offset. And unless something has changed very, very, very recently, that just is not true. Under the windfall tax provisions of law, windfall income provision, you reduce the amount that you receive in retirement if you are both drawing from Social Security and a pension, government pension, of course, whether it's teacher's pension, state pension, railroad pension, whatever it happens to be, there is a reduction. So make sure you have your ducks lined up and you know exactly what you're talking about. When you're visiting with Social Security, I would go to the Social Security office, sit down face-to-face, and make sure that, if possible, you get something in writing about when you start benefits, how much it's going to be, and that it is or is not going to be affected by other income that you may be receiving. So one last thing, there has been some discussion, as with changes in retirement plans. The Supreme Court just ruled that church plans are indeed exempt from ERISA. What does that mean? Well, churches, as you know, as defined under the IRS code, anyone who has a church, a retirement plan established by a church, will have the ability of not having to comply with ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, in funding or designing or operating eligibility and so forth, their retirement plan. There was a split decision in the lower courts. It finally went to the Supreme Court, and they said that churches can indeed set up a plan, a church plan, as defined under Section 333 of ERISA, is exempt from the compliance reporting disclosure requirements imposed by ERISA, including the minimum funding standards. So if you have a church, or in this case, potentially a principal-purposed organization, because many hospitals are indeed part of church organizations, and they do have plans, which in this with this ruling may or may not be subject to ERISA. So you got to know what you're dealing with. You know, ask enough questions. If you can't get the answers, then call an expert. Call somebody who can help you approach that to find out that you do know what you're dealing with on those issues. And without further ado, as they say, what's the title of your new book, Terry?
You Don't Know What You Don't Know.
I don't know what I don't know. That's for sure. I found that out a long time ago. Everything you need to know to buy or sell a business. And that really, for those of us who, by whatever means, have become entrepreneurs, in my case, it was somewhat by accident, somewhat by choice. You learn a lot of things, but there are many things that you learn along the way that you wish you had known in the beginning. So what Terry has done, and his our relationship goes back, I think, more than 20 years, working on the retirement plan for an oil company that he owned and subsequently sold, and then got into the area of business valuations, became a certified valuation expert. So tell us a little bit about the background of how you got into this business and the oil business you started with, Terry.
So it was a family business, a wholesale fuel and lubricants. So we sold to farmers, excavating, trucking companies, stuff like that. So grew up with the business, came back, worked outside of the business for a little bit, came back in 1991, bought our first company in 1992. And over the course of about the next 18 years, had the opportunity to buy 11 other companies. And then one day you kind of get that itch and you think, well, I wonder what this thing's worth. So I had somebody value the company. They came up with a number and it's like, well, if we can sell it for that, it'd be a good move for our family. And that's eventually what ended up happening. So one of the things that I talk about in the book is having a plan for after you sell your company, which is one of the things that I didn't do. And after 3 months of watching the Today Show in the morning and Price is Right at noon and Oprah in the afternoon, the wife said, you need to get a job. So Regions Bank called me. I did commercial banking for 3.5 years and got my entrepreneurial itch back and got my CVA designation, Certified Valuation Analyst, and my partner Dave Kunkel and I in July of 2014 started Innovative Business Advisors, and we help people buy and sell companies, mainly on the sell side, do business valuations for a number of reasons, whether it's somebody, you know, wanting to sell a business or somebody buying into a business or, you know, there's business divorce, estate planning. So a number of reasons to value a business. And then also do consulting work, helping people build value in their companies and really making the company more sellable.
Well, and there's a lot that goes into what you're talking
Pretty
about.
Pretty simple, right?
When I made the transition over 20 years ago and bought my first business, I did buy it from my brother. I didn't really know a whole lot about the business or what he did, but it seemed like a good idea. And we did handwrite a one-page contract and entered a five-year buyout, and I bought it. And as they say, the rest is history. You know, some 30-plus or almost 30 years later, it worked out to be one of the best things I ever did. Subsequently, I did buy a couple of other businesses in the same field. And then, as Terry knows, there was an opportunity came up somewhat unsolicited, but you plant seeds, and you know, as an entrepreneur and as being in business, you never know when those seeds are going to produce fruit. I say specifically because two examples. I got a call yesterday from a large CPA firm that I've been talking to in St. Louis for a number of years, who they do retirement plan audits. And we don't do audits, but we certainly do all of the peripheral testing administration relating to it. And I've been hoping to, you know, have an opportunity to show them what we could do. And I got a call yesterday from one of the CPAs who indicated that they wanted to refer us to a large plan in the area, which was having some issues on their testing and with the IRS and the DOL. And they wanted us to come in and do a complete evaluation of the plan and fix what needed to be fixed and tell them how to keep it from happening again. So, you know, that took over 5 years from beginning to end to even get a referral. And the other example is last September, so not quite a year ago, a gentleman walked into my office and was ready to retire and said, you know, do you want to buy my business? And that started a six-month discussion and in looking at it and doing the cash flow, and as we'll get into it, there were a lot of things I didn't know, particularly about financing a deal like that. Ended up going through talking to five different banks over a period of time, and that was really the biggest hang-up, is to get the financing in place. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that. And so what are the pros and cons of buying an existing company, Terry?
To me, the biggest pro is you have an existing cash flow. We started Innovative from scratch, and it's just difficult. You got all the marketing plans you got to come up with. You know, you're discounting the first customers you're getting versus we bought another company in October of 2015 that was an existing 35-year-old company, and the next week got a paycheck. So a lot of these companies, and it's been my experience, you know, with buying different companies, you know, the big advantage is that existing cash flow, and any improvements you make to that company fall straight to the bottom line.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And we work here on the campus of beautiful campus of Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville, with the Small Business Development Center. SBDC, as they call it. They also have an entrepreneurship center, and they work with a lot of startups. And startups have their own unique challenges. We've got several in our building in various areas of development. And, you know, funding is probably the number one. There's a gross underestimation of how much money it's going to take to get a company off the ground, particularly if you have a product that has to be manufactured, it has to be submitted to organizations or governmental entities for approvals. It can take, I know one startup that we're working with, and I think is just about on the edge of success, as they would define it, it's been 5 or 6 years. I mean, it's not something in most cases, unless you're going to go out and sell snow cones.
And, you know, the funding of it, you know, most banks won't lend to a startup company until they've had 3 years under their belt. That's a long time.
Well, and that's the same thing with insurance. You know, when somebody comes to Christie and says, hey, you know, we've got this roofing company, we've got this tree trimming company, that's a good one, we've got this whatever company, and we just, you know, I've been doing this stuff for years, but now I started my own company, and you have no history, because the insurance carrier's looking at it going, hey, you know, how do we know this guy really knows, or gal, what they're doing? So they're somewhat reluctant to provide insurance, and if they do, it's going to be at a premium to make sure that they can cover any losses that occur. So there are, what are some of the cons of buying an existing company?
You're inheriting a lot of stuff, you know, if the former owner wasn't doing things correctly. Sometimes you buy a company, and if they had a bad reputation, you know, you may have a hard time changing that. So those are some of the things that can be challenging. Or if they got systems in place that are outdated, you know, replacing phone systems or computer systems, that could be a little bit of a challenge and expensive. So that's all stuff that really needs to come out in the due diligence process. But it kind of goes along with, you don't know what you don't know. If you don't know to ask the question, then, you know, it's one of those things you get in, you don't find out until you get into it.
Exactly. And, you know, when you're looking at an existing company, looks are deceiving. You know, it may appear on the outside to be very successful, but you really have to dig into the inside of a question, inside of the company, to and ask the right questions to determine just what's going on.
Especially if you're inheriting employees, that can be a real challenge. Sometimes you get in there and find out you've got two or three employees that just aren't the right fit. Now, how do you get rid of them without upsetting the other employees or upsetting customers? So that can definitely be a challenge.
Due diligence is probably the number one thing that's overlooked. So in that case, what are the steps in the process of buying a company as you see it?
The first step is by far determining the cash flow that's coming from the statement or coming from the company. I'm sorry, and I think the process, the term that you would call, is normalizing the financial statements. So one, hopefully they have good financial statements. That can be a challenge, especially if you're buying a smaller business. Two, the next thing that you really need to go through and do is determine what's the true cash flow coming from that company. In other words, what I mean by normalizing it is taking all what personal things is that business paying for the former owner. Need to get that out of there and get down to the true cash flow of the company.
What would be some examples of those personal items?
Cell phones, kids' cell phones, vehicles, lake house, groceries. And, you know, those things are, they can be called add backs. You're going to add back in, you know, those items. Main thing is they need to be documented. You know, if you're trying to buy the company and the owner's coming to you and saying, well, I just, you know, it's about $20,000. Well, I would be very cautious of that. Another thing that's important to look at is what's the owner's salary that's coming out of the company and is it reported on the financial statement? So that can be a big deal. Sometimes the owner's not paying themselves anything and you really want to buy a business if you can't pay yourself something. Or I do see a lot of cases where it's a successful business and the owner may be paying themselves a salary that's way above what would be considered a market average. So that's another thing to be thinking about and normalizing.
And I guess one of the factors, one of the many unknowns is it a business you really want to get into?
What's the future of it? You know, can you grow it? Can you repeat it? Is there recurring revenue? That's one of the main drivers of buying any business. You know, does it have recurring revenue? You're talking about an insurance company. That's a company with good recurring revenue. A good example would be a construction company. You know, say you're a home builder. Well, once you've built that house, now you got to go find another house to build. That's not recurring revenue. That was something that was nice with the oil company that I owned. It's recurring revenue. You know, we had a lot of farm accounts. The farmers are going to farm every year. If you're delivering fuel to a municipality, the fire trucks, police cars, you know, they're all going to run and they're consistently going to be buying fuel.
So I've got this idea. I may have found a company or maybe looking for a company. So what are some of the questions that I'm going to want to ask as I'm in my search?
For a company that you're interested in?
Right.
That's a good question. The financial statements are a big thing. What their customers are like, is their customer concentration? So in other words, you know, does 80% of their revenue come from three or four customers? That can be a real pitfall. You know, same way with suppliers. So if they're buying something and reselling it, are you going to be able to get that contract? That can be a big deal.
Well, we found over the years, and I could take time to name a half a dozen different types of businesses that were very profitable and very successful for many years, you know, sometimes 30, 40, 50 years, and they became obsolete because they didn't adapt, they didn't adjust to the times.
You always got to be changing.
Well, you do, and it was, I think of one, this goes back 20 years or more, there was a company in St. Louis, very successful, and all they did was manufacture brass gas pump nozzles, and they rebuilt them and whatnot, and well, guess what happened to them? All the brass gas pump nozzles went away and were replaced by plastic and other metals, yeah. And the business did not adapt, and they pretty shortly went out of business.
Yeah, anything, especially something technology related, you know, technology changes, and the next thing you know, you've got an outdated product.
Would you recommend buying a franchise?
I don't think there's anything wrong with buying a franchise, you know, especially if you're starting a company from scratch. You know, you buy a franchise and all that marketing, website, it's all in place for you. I talk to a lot of people that own franchises, and from the get-go, it's great. 5 years down the road, all of a sudden paying that franchise fee isn't as popular as it was when you first started. So, you know, so franchises are good. Sometimes the franchise will change and mandate things that you have to do to your stores for updates there's always advantages and disadvantages, but there's brokers out there, that's all they do is sell franchises.
Yeah, I never did look at that. I've talked to a number of people who have purchased franchises, and even in our local area, I know several that own, multiple fast food restaurants or multiple ice cream places or whatever, and they do quite well for themselves and continue to expand. But I don't know, tying myself into making a significant payment for life, basically, under that type of agreement probably wouldn't be something I'd ever be interested in. So when we get into approaching the value of a company, you know, looking at it, you know, this is an industry I might be interested in getting into. It seems on the surface that it's profitable. What are generally the approaches that are used to value a company?
It's the same as valuing a house. There's the income approach, which you're valuing the cash flow of the business, the market approach, which is most common in real estate. So if you have a house on this corner that is a three-bedroom house with a two-car garage and it's sold for $175,000 and there's a house on the other corner, three-bedroom, two-car garage, same size, it's probably worth $175,000. The market approach is not commonly used in valuing a business. The third approach would be the asset approach, where you're valuing the assets of the company. This is typically done with a company that's not generating enough cash flow to create a value greater than the assets that it takes to create that cash flow.
Yeah, I think it's important to know in the qualified plan business, the first question I ask when one of my clients comes to me and says, our company's being sold or we're buying another company, either way that it goes is, you know, was it an asset purchase or was it a stock purchase? Because they're treated differently for tax purposes, they're treated differently legally, and you know it varies as to how one of many things the qualified plan has to be approached in terms of continuation and merger and so forth. So if you're looking at the income approach, what are some of the things that you would look for in the valuation?
The main thing that you're going to do on the income approach is, you know, you are valuing the cash flow that's coming from that company. So as we mentioned earlier, normalizing that cash flow is very important. You'll get down to what you EBITDA, earnings before interest, taxes, and amortization.
That's a term I had not heard until about 2 years ago.
Really? It's surprising. There's two things. Seller's discretionary income is the next thing. So think of seller's discretionary income as all of the income coming in from that company that's at the seller's discretion on how they spend it, whether it's for them personally as far as a salary or if it's going to make a loan payment. So then, you know, you're really looking at what's the return on my investment. And most companies, companies that are under $2 million in value are likely to sell with a return on investment of 3 to 5 years, meaning if you purchase that company, you should expect to earn a return on your investment that you could pay for that company in 3 to 5 years. And that's consistently going to match up with terms that a bank will give you to buy that company.
Yeah, because banks are, you know, if you have an asset purchase and you have particularly property or you have something that's easily valued, banks are all over it.
Yes.
In my experience.
There's two, you know, I think one of the good takeaways somebody could take away from the show is, you know, there's two sides to every loan. You got collateral, you know, what am I going to take in case you don't pay this loan back? And cash flow, what's the cash flow coming back from this company to pay for what you're purchasing?
Yeah, and when you don't have an asset purchase, you do have an income purchase, if you will. It's tough. There are banks out there that they just, you know, absolutely will not do it. There are a few that will consider it, but then it goes, you know, if you're going to a bank and you want to justify, and that's basically what you're doing, justify purchasing an income-related business, what are some of the things that you would advise the owner to do in advance of going to the bank?
The owner of the business going to the bank, it's just so important. I can't put enough emphasis on having good financial statements. And, you know, go to a CPA. You know, if you're a much smaller business and you got a bookkeeper, that's great. But, you know, one of the things that I see, it's like people get lazy with their financial statements. So even if you're using a CPA, when's the last time you sat down with them and said, you know, what do we really need to, you know, change? Is there anything that we need to change? Sometimes you get a financial statement from a company and it'll have 40 items on the income and expenses, which is just way too much. It can be consolidated down. Other times, I've gotten a financial statement where in the sales, they have sales 18, sales 19, sales 20. Well, what's that, you know? I asked the owner, and he's like, oh, that's groceries, you know. He knew what it was right off the top of his head. But if somebody else is looking at those financial statements, they need to be readable. And you need to have 3 to 5 years' worth of information.
Well, it's good to have the history. And one of the things that a lot of business owners who haven't had a lot of accounting or a lot of financial training, talk a little bit about what the three basic types of financial statements are and what you might expect to see.
Sure. So there's three types of financial statements. Compiled statements is the most common, and that's basically you're bringing your financial information to a CPA or bookkeeper, and they are compiling it. So there's not a lot of checks and balances to that. The next step, if you get up to where you got about $3 to $5 million worth of credit, you're probably, the bank is the one that most often drives this, you're going to be asked for reviewed financial statements. In that process, a CPA is going through and they're at least doing some checks. You know, they're going to say, okay, does this accounts receivable make sense for this size of company? Does the inventory make sense for this type of company?
So that's an example of when I get the letter from one of our vendors that we work with or one of our clients, and it's from an accounting firm saying, you know, our records show as of, you know, June 30th, the receivable on your books is X. You know, please verify and send this back.
Correct.
So they're just reviewing it.
They're reviewing it. So in the CPA, so what gets important about this is a CPA is going to sign off on those reviewed statements saying that they've done certain things and they're reasonably sure that this information is accurate. The third, and it's going to cost you, I had reviewed statements with the oil company, and that came with a nice little price tag of around $10,000. So the third type of financial statements is audited. And, you know, when you get into audited statements, there's a long laundry list of things that are going to be done. And, you know, they are definitely, they're going to follow the flow of the sales transaction. They'll probably go out and count some inventory. They'll call customers to see if the accounts receivable is correct. I'm not going to pretend I know the whole process, but it's much more detailed and much more expensive.
Yeah, no doubt about that. I mean, it's the most complete, the most accurate representation of the company. But even at that, there are still things that may not be covered. So we've got it, you know, we found our company. We're looking at cash flow. We're looking at assets. We're looking at whatnot. And we have different financial statements to peruse to try and get down to the actual, okay, if I buy this, what costs are going to continue? What costs are not, what income is continuing, you know, what's the likelihood of the income continuing, what kind of attrition can you assume in terms of existing clients. So should you always have an attorney involved in this process?
Attorney's very important in the process. I think you do need to have an attorney involved to write up a purchase agreement for you. One thing that, and I got a chapter in the book talking about attorneys, is don't let your attorney take over the don't take over the transaction. I've seen it too many times where you just costs go crazy, or the attorney wants to take an opinion to once way far to the left or to the right, you know. And probably the most important thing, though, is I can tell you about having an attorney involved, is getting it. Make sure you have an attorney that's versed in mergers and acquisitions. I recently was involved in a transaction where they went to their estate planning attorney. That's not the right person to go to. Go, you know, if you need estate planning, go to an estate planning attorney. If you're doing a mergers and acquisitions transaction, go to an attorney that is versed in mergers and acquisitions.
And I think the bottom line there is the person who has done it before and is familiar with it, it's going to cost you less because they've been there and done that. They know what the documents are. You know, they change the name, the time, the dates, and so forth.
And if you're a sailor, it's, you know, in the book I talk about building your team, you know. So there's chapters on financial advisors, attorneys, CPAs, who am I missing? Attorneys, CPAs, financial advisors, bankers. So you need to have all these people engaged. And the CPA is very important from a tax standpoint. You know, if you're selling your company, there's huge tax implications. And the way you structure the sale of that company can really affect what you're going to get after the sale.
I think even a lot of very, very smart business owners don't understand depreciation and recapture of depreciation.
Yeah. Well, one, you know, when I own the company, it's like depreciation is a non-cash expense. So banks do add that back to the cash flow of the company. Mm-hmm. So if you question that, I have people come to me, well, we'd be a real profitable company if we just didn't have just earned depreciation. Well, that's a non-cash expense. That gets added back into the cash flow of your company. But when you're going to sell your company, if you have – that's – so here's something to think about. The price of the company is one thing, and that can be determined. When the next – hurdle you will get to is the allocation of the purchase price to the assets of the company. And that is where there can be some major tax consequences. The seller is always going to want to receive as much goodwill as possible because that's taxed at a lower rate than ordinary income. So if you have a truck that's depreciated down to $500 and all of a sudden you allocate $50,000 to that truck, you're going to have $45,500 of ordinary income, which is going to be taxed at around probably 40%.
Yeah, and that's it really is important to bring your team together, the attorney, the CPA. What about you? How do you choose the right bank?
Ask questions.
Good question.
Yeah,
right?
good question. Because certain banks, not everybody, I think, thinks banks are all the same, and they're not. If you are buying a company that doesn't have a lot of assets and there's a lot of goodwill and an SBA loan makes sense, I would recommend going to a bank that's a preferred lender or at least if they're not a preferred lender with the SBA, they do SBA loans. There's a lot of paperwork involved in that and it can get bogged down real quickly. Other banks, if you're buying a building, some banks like real estate, some don't. There is a big difference in banks and you know, it's important that you ask the right questions. You know, I think you mentioned it with buying an insurance company recently. That can be challenging because there's not a lot of assets that go along with that. And, you know, you got to find a bank that's comfortable with a transaction like that.
Yeah, there's no question about it. It was a real eye-opener. And frankly, we negotiated the purchase price within 30, 60 days, you know, did some due diligence, interviewed all of the existing staff. We were kind of happy with everything we saw, the location, et cetera, and we any unknowns, we were willing to accept the risk and mitigate that. But when it came to the bank, as I've shared with Terry before, we had one bank that was all in and had told us that we had the loan committee's approval to go ahead. And it was about 2 days later, we got a call from one of the senior loan officers saying that well, upper management had halted the deal and decided they're not going to do it. You know, no warning, no explanation, no nothing. And we had invested 6 or 8 weeks getting to that point, and all of a sudden it was all for nothing. So my personal recommendation is don't just talk to one bank.
Exactly. And I agree 100%. It's always, I would recommend talking to three banks. If you're an existing company, don't hang your hat on one bank. I would be talking to another bank. You never know what's going to change within that bank. I had that happen to me personally. At the end, I had two banks that I worked with and a third one that I gave financial information just in case something happened to one of the other two. So it's important. And, you know, if you're an existing business and you're looking at acquisitions as a way to grow, even if you're not looking at an acquisition, I would talk to your banker on a regular basis. It's very important that they know what's going on with your company and, you know, be asking them questions on what do they think about your financial statements and what are they looking at to judge your company.
Well, and a question that I'm kind of skipping around a little bit in the outline of the book here, but near and dear to my heart, what about choosing or do you need a financial advisor in this type of transaction?
Absolutely, especially if you're the seller of the company. Again, your financial advisor can be very important, just as important as your CPA in helping you structure that purchase to minimize the tax effect. You know, we recently did a transaction with a company this spring where we set up a deferred compensation program, and we was able to save the seller over $100,000 in taxes. That's a big number.
That is significant. And, you know, bringing them in, and I can't emphasize this enough because we run into it periodically with qualified retirement plans that as a financial advisor to the retirement plan, and at least in those cases, we are the last one who finds anything out. And typically it's, oh, by the way, we've negotiated a deal to sell the company and it's closing in, you know, 30, 60, 90 days. And we're kind of like, okay. What about the retirement plan? Well, we thought we'd deal with that later. Well, you got to deal with it now because I can think of some horror stories, particularly if an existing company has a pension plan. That's a huge, huge potential issue because most, I won't say all, but many pension plans, as the news has reported, are underfunded significantly. I think the average funding on a pension plan today is somewhere in the 60-65%, which is well under the legal requirement for funding pension plans. But nevertheless, through a variety of laws, regulations, changes that have been made over the years, that they are underfunded. And when you buy the company, guess what? You bought that underfunded liability. So I've seen companies where they had as much as $1 million in underfunded liability that they were going to be subject to in purchasing the company. And if it's a small company, that may be more than what the company's worth.
Yeah. And you know, building that team of advisors is just so important as a business owner. You know, you can't know everything, and you need to ask those questions of your team. You know, they should be part of your team. It's sad that a lot of owners get to the point where they want to sell the company and they haven't asked the questions, and now all of a sudden they find out they have an unsellable company because of something like that.
And it's huge. And you know, and one of the questions in your book is, you know, what are the dangers of investing all your money in a 401k?
Yes, you know, a 401k. There's a term for it. I got to get it off the top of my head here. But it's assets that are hard to get to if you want to use that in purchasing a company. There is a way to do it by creating a C corp, but you know, we can get that's a whole nother story of, you know, why you don't want to have a C corporation. But if you're an employee right now and you have aspirations of owning a company, I would be careful about sinking all of your money into a 401k. I believe they call that a qualified asset that you can't easily pull out to use as collateral. While I worked at the bank, you know, you'd have somebody come in and it's like, here's my collateral for this loan, and it was a couple hundred thousand dollars in a 401k, and they're very displeased to find out that they can't use that.
It's not assignable by law under the ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, and federal law prohibits assignment of an IRA or a 401k for any purpose. You cannot borrow from an IRA. You can, in some limited capacity, borrow from a 401k. You can borrow up to 50% of the vested account value, not to exceed $50,000. And it has to be repaid within no more than 5 years, 60 months. So it's limited in terms of getting money out. So it really depends on what you're trying to do down the road in dealing with that. And again, managing, there are ways that Terry and I have talked about. And if someone is close to retirement within 5 to 10 years and they have not adequately funded their retirement, and maybe their business is not sellable or it may be difficult to sell, there are ways that we can set up not only a 401k but a cash balance plan, which would allow us to put in upwards of $125,000 to $150,000 a year on a pre-tax basis, which could be paid out of the company. And in some cases, if they want to transition it to a family member, son, daughter, whoever, you know, they could fund that for 5 to 10 years. And all of a sudden, mom or dad has $1 million sitting there they can retire on. The transition has been completed. There may be some discounting the value of the stock of the company during the transition. So they get into pretty complex issues, both from a tax and a legal standpoint. But there are ways of not only putting money away in the sale of a company, but allowing you to maximize your retirement in the process.
Yeah, and the key is just planning. You can't, you know, it's a 3 to 5 year process if you want to do it. If there's such a thing as perfect, but you know, waking up one morning and say, "I think I'm going to sell my company today," it creates a lot of problems.
So we're coming down the last 5 minutes or so. Believe it or not, time flies when you're having fun. But what would you say to someone who has an entrepreneurial bug, or who knows of a business they just like to get into?
Do your research. Know the questions that you're asked, you know, that you need to ask to go through the due diligence process. That's a hard thing. People come to me all the time and say, I want to buy a business. And the next question is, what do you want to buy? And then they say, I don't know. So it can be difficult to figure out what you want to buy. Those are hard questions. When you find a company that you do want to buy, approaching that owner, someday you may want to use an intermediary, somebody to help you negotiate that. That's something that we do quite a bit of, but you could also use your CPA or a banker to help you through that process. So getting to the true cash flow of the company and getting to know the person is all important in that process.
Well, I think it all goes back to planning, as you've mentioned multiple times, and making sure that you bring your team together, talk to your banker, talk to your attorney, talk to your financial advisor, talk to your accountant, talk to someone dealing in the acquisition or sale of businesses, similar to what Terry does, because they're going to have perspectives that you probably don't have because you don't know what you don't know. And this is, in essence, can be a windfall. It can also be extremely detrimental to your financial future if you don't do it right.
Yeah, and you know the biggest deal killer in buying and selling businesses is a business that's overpriced. Very oftentimes the owner will have an overly high expectation of the value of that business. And one of the key things I would say in going into that, is it a bankable deal? If the bank isn't willing to loan money for the price that the owner's asking for the company, it's probably priced too high.
Yeah, do you really want to buy it if the bank doesn't want to?
Yeah, if the bank doesn't want to finance it. And, the other thing I see is they will ask for an overly high price. And then on an SBA loan, you can get out to a 9-year amortization schedule. So, but I think what you really need to ask yourself is, do you really want to still be paying for that company 7 or 8 years after you've bought it? You should be able to pay that back in 3 to 5 years.
Well, it would be ideal, and every situation is different. So, you need to think long and hard about it. You need to take a look at it and, coming out. Tell us when your book will be coming out, Terry.
The book will be out next month in July.
Okay.
So it's about mergers and acquisitions. The beginning of the book talks about buying companies and valuing a company and the process of buying a company. The middle of the book, I say, is talking about building that team. So there's chapters on attorneys, bankers, financial advisors, CPAs, and then it transitions into bankability, what debt service coverage, what's global debt service coverage, and then building value in the company to make it sellable, and in the process of selling the company and some of the potholes to avoid and confidentiality. And then the last chapter is about, what do you do with your life after you sold the company? Have a plan for that as well.
Well, and I talk about that with everyone who does a financial plan with either John Graney or myself, is you got to have a plan. You can't just quit life. You may be changing careers. You may have more money than you had expected or you've had in the past, but you got to figure out what you're going to do.
And, and in the book, I talk about, I had, my personal experiences and things that I feel like that I did right and things that I should have done differently. And that's something I should have done differently. I had no idea what I was going to do with myself after the sale of the company.
You didn't know what you didn't know, did you?
That's right.
So how can they contact you, Terry?
The web address for the company is www.innovativeba.com. My email is Terry, Terry, at InnovativeBA, or feel free to give me a call. My phone number is 618-530-8922.
Thanks for coming on. I think it's been a great discussion, and anybody out there who either is thinking about selling or buying a business, it certainly is worth a phone call. If they contact you on your website, they can probably get a copy of your book. I would suspect
we'll have a link on there.
It would be an ideal read for someone thinking about going into this area. So good information. We'll have you back, and we'll maybe dig in a little deeper to some of these topics as we go forward. But if you have questions about buying or selling a business, or valuing a business, it's a great time to give Terry a call, talk to him. He'll be upfront with you and tell you how it works and what options you do have and how to proceed from that standpoint. So you're listening to WSIE-FM 88.7, The Sound, on the campus of Southern Illinois. Illinois University, Edwardsville. This is The Financial Cafe. You can reach us at thefinancialcafe.us. Send us a link or send us a an email. You can contact John Graney at jgraney@nicolfinancial.com or llexo@nicolfinancial.com. And we, John will be back, hopefully with or without Fish. When he is back ready to go, we'll have another show coming down the line. And we have a couple of guests scheduled in July. So we will look forward. Terry, thanks for coming on board with us today. I think a lot of good information.
Have a great day.
You've been listening to The Financial Cafe, airing every Saturday at 9 a.m. on 88.7 WSIE The Sound. Today's show is underwritten by The Chef Shop in Edwardsville, your hometown kitchen accessory store, where a good cup of coffee starts every day right. Listeners are invited to send your questions regarding retirement, investments, or any other financial topic that may pique your interest. Send the questions to John at jgraney@nicolfinancial.com or to Larry at llexo@nicolfinancial.com. John and Larry will discuss those questions each week during their Q&A session. If you prefer, they will respond to you in private. Thanks for listening to The Financial Cafe on 88.7 WSIE The Sound.